Good morning to all of you. We are going to be looking this morning at Genesis chapter 33. So I have been preaching on the subject of the patriarchs, and I'm planning to do two sermons on Jacob meeting Esau. And we're going to be thinking specifically on the subject of forgiveness. And maybe this feels a little shoehorned in here. I feel like Jacob and Esau should have had forgiveness. They needed to have forgiveness, and maybe they didn't have it. Maybe Jacob is a life full of bad examples, things that you shouldn't do. You know, sometimes you read stories about people and you think, you know, smart people wouldn't do what that person does. And things worked out okay for Jacob, so we'd say, well, you know, maybe it worked out. Maybe God just blesses in spite of our fallibility and our weaknesses. So I would say that there's some things that I would like to say up front before we delve into things. And I just want these things to be clear because I think sometimes these things get taken out of context. So first of all, I don't think we can judge somebody else's level of forgiveness. So you can't tell whether somebody is working on forgiveness if they have forgiven somebody just by looking at them. There's no dial on their forehead. We say that doctors can't judge other people's pain. We can't judge other people's pain. There's no way. You can judge what their blood pressure is and their temperature and things like that, but you can't judge certain things just by looking at them. Second is that forgiveness is not an all or nothing thing. So we think of forgiveness as being something either you've done it or you haven't done it, and I think that forgiveness is something that takes work. And the final thing is that forgiveness is not a fix for trauma. So some people have this idea that if you just forgive the people who have hurt you, that everything goes away. Poof, it's magic, and it's not. And it takes time, and it takes effort, and trauma is hard. So there are lots of examples in Scripture of brothers who didn't get along. As I was thinking about brothers who didn't get along, of course, the first one that came to my mind was Cain and Abel. Abel was the older son. And Cain was the younger son, and we know very little about them, except that one of them was a shepherd and one of them raised crops. And both of them brought sacrifices, and Abel's sacrifice was accepted, and Cain's was rejected, and there was tension in their relationship from that point forward. Cain was angry with his brother, and God actually spoke to Cain and said, "Are you right to be angry with Abel?" And the question is, was Cain right to be angry with Abel? Well, it wasn't Abel's fault that Cain's sacrifice was rejected. But it's easier to be angry with your brother than it is to be angry with God. And Cain continued in his anger and ended up killing his brother. Rudolf and Adolf Dassler were German shoe manufacturers, and they were also brothers. You can imagine that because they have the same last name. And with names like Rudolf and Adolf, they should have been twins, right? You know, people always rhyme twins' names. I don't know if y'all noticed that. They don't always, but it's not unusual. And as far as I can tell, they were not twins. For 30 years, they were shoe manufacturers. So they began manufacturing shoes together in 1919, with a company that I'm going to butcher the name, but it was called the Gebrüder Dassler Schuhfabrik, or Gita for short. Gita is easier, so we'll just call it Gita. So 30 years, Gita is operating. They're making shoes for the world. And then in 1948, the brothers announced that they were closing Gita. It's done. It's all done. No more shoes from these brothers. And nobody knows why the brothers were angry with each other. Some people speculated their wives couldn't get along. Some people say that it was that Rudolf was drafted into the German army and that he thought that Adolf was part of the reason why he got drafted. Nobody really knows, but they stopped and they started their own shoe companies, which is, of course, what you do whenever you get mad at your brother. You're going to make good. So having worked together for 30 years in this shoe company, it's doing well, they split up, and they started their own shoe companies. So Adolf's company is still around today. It's called Adidas. And Rudolf's shoe brand is around too. It's not quite as popular, but it's called Puma. And so even when the brothers died, they got buried in the same cemetery, but they picked plots at the very opposite extremes of the cemetery just to be sure that they weren't buried close to each other. So even in death, they were separated. That's kind of a sad story, isn't it? You'd like to hear it, some reconciliation where on his deathbed, Adolf was lying there and Rudolf came in and said, you know, brother, you know, I wish that we had gotten along. Will you forgive me for the things I said? And they went back, but it wasn't that way. And so we come here, and the author of Genesis has built up the tension for us. Jacob has increasing fear as he draws near to his brother. He remembers their parting. His mother told him that Esau wanted to kill him, that she would send for him soon once Esau's anger cooled down. And she never sent for him. And now Jacob hears that Esau is coming to meet him with 400 men. And the only thing he can think is that Esau wants to kill him. I think it's important for us to remember that our actions have effects on other people. So Jacob could have rationalized all of his actions away. This was mostly his mother's fault. His mother had told him to put goat skin on him and steal the blessing. Esau wasn't a very good person. We know that too. But at the end of the day, he had hurt Esau significantly and damaged their relationship. And in a sense, his future would come down to question of whether or not Esau would forgive him. So let's read Genesis chapter 33. Now Jacob lifted up his eyes and looked, and there Esau was coming, and with him were 400 men. So he divided the children among Leah, Rachel, and the two maidservants. And he put the maidservants and their children in front, Leah and her children behind, and Rachel and Joseph last. Then he crossed over before them and bowed himself to the ground 7 times until he came near to his brother. But Esau ran to meet him and embraced him and fell on his neck and kissed him, and they wept. And he lifted his eyes and saw the women and children and said, "Who are these with you?" So he said, "The children whom God has graciously given your servant." Then the maidservants came near, they and their children, and bowed down. And Leah also came near with her children, and they bowed down. Afterwards, Joseph and Rachel came near, and they bowed down. Then Esau said, "What do you mean by all this company which I met?" And he said, "These are to find favor in the sight of your Lord, my Lord." So if you all remember, Jacob had sent a gift ahead to Esau, a pretty sizable gift. And Esau's asking about that. And he said, but Esau said, "I have enough, my brother. Keep what you have for yourself." And Jacob said, "No, please, if I've now found favor in your sight, then receive my present from my hand, inasmuch as I have seen your face as though I had seen the face of God, and you were pleased with me. Please take my blessing that is brought to you because God has dealt graciously with me and because I have enough." So he urged him and he took it. Then Esau said, "Let us take our journey. Let us go and I will go before you." But Jacob said to him, "My Lord knows that the children are weak and the flocks and herds which are nursing are with me. And if the men should drive them hard one day, all the flock will die. Please let my Lord go on ahead before his servant. I will lead on slowly at a pace which the livestock that go before me and the children are able to endure until I come to my Lord in Seir." And Esau said, "Now let me leave with you some of the people who are with me." But he said, "What need is there? Let me find favor in the sight of my Lord." So Esau returned that day on his way to Seir. So the two brothers meet, and Jacob is not at his best. I don't know if you all remember last time, but Jacob has been wrestling all night. He's not gotten a wink of sleep. How many of you all are better after you miss a night of sleep? Wow, nobody. I'm never better. You know, doctors have times during their training where they have to be up all night, and they're never sharper after spending 24 or 36 hours awake. Sometimes they have to do it, okay? There's times in your life where you've got sick people that you're caring for, whatever it is, and you don't get much sleep, and you're always grouchier, and you're always more irritable. And so he's been up all night wrestling. So of all the things you can be doing during the night when you're sleepless, wrestling is the worst thing. I'm not sure what the top 10 list is, but that's definitely up there. And he's walking with a limp. So he's had a dislocated hip. No doctor's handy to put it back into socket. And he's just limping along, hardly getting across. And he's feeling exhausted. He's in pain. And if he had any thoughts of running away, they're gone. So if you've ever chased somebody with a dislocated hip, it's not hard to catch them. It's very easy, actually. And so you could catch Jacob if you were the slowest person here. I don't know who the slowest person is here, but you run faster than Jacob could. And so Jacob has shown his favoritism. We talked about this already. We're going to see this down the road, but Jacob had favorites. And he divided his family up. So you can tell how Jacob ranked the family. So first of all, he takes the concubines and their children. He sticks them out front. You know, if Esau is going to catch any of his family, he wants it to be these people. And then next he puts Leah and her children, and last of all, Rachel and Joseph. And we can see here the seeds that were sowed that would end up creating a lot of tension between Joseph and his brothers. But we're not going to get into that this morning. So Jacob showed bravery. After dividing the party up, he went out in front. So he's the person who is going to take Esau's wrath. And he maybe thought he was going to his death, but he hoped that if Esau did kill him, that things would settle down, everybody else would get away. So he'd already given a generous gift to Esau. He prayed a very humble, earnest prayer, but he did not have a lot of faith that he was going to make it through this encounter. So he comes to Esau. He bows 7 times on the way to meeting Esau, saying, "I am your servant. Whatever I have is yours." And Esau did not act as though he remembered the offense, does he? 20 couple years have passed, and he runs to meet Jacob. He embraces him, and they both start crying. Now, Esau is crying because he is so glad to see his brother. He missed his brother. Never thought he'd say that he missed Jacob, but he actually missed Jacob. And Jacob is crying with relief because he doesn't think his brother's going to kill him. That's a good thing, too. He's like, wow. I've got tears of joy. And Esau basically says, "I am super glad to see you." I don't know why he didn't hold a grudge, but he didn't want to take Jacob's gift, did he? He sort of says, "Look, I've got enough." I don't know how much Esau had, but whatever it was, he wasn't striving to get more. He's, you know, "I've got plenty." And so, you know, maybe Esau was just putting things on, but I just don't think these sorts of things really, they were valuable to him. And maybe there's some negative to that. Maybe Esau didn't always value the stuff that was really important, but it also meant that he didn't carry grudges the way some other people do. Jacob insisted on giving the gift anyway. And notice carefully the words that he uses. "Please take my blessing that is brought to you." So Jacob is giving back the blessing that he stole. So Esau then asked Jacob to come with him. And we're going to talk about this a little bit more the next sermon. But Jacob is told by Esau, "Move in next door to me." And Jacob didn't feel comfortable with that. You see him making all sorts of excuses. And finally, he lies to Esau and says, "Absolutely, I'm going to come, but don't worry about it. I'll just take my time." And he ended up settling 65 or 70 miles away from where Esau lived. And, you know, there's something to be said for the fact that Jacob didn't feel comfortable even telling Esau his discomfort with being close to him. So I would like to spend a bunch of time here thinking about forgiveness. And I thought that as a way of introducing this, I would talk a little bit about my own experience. So many of you probably know, but my parents got divorced when I was about 14 years old, and things had not been going very well in our family for a few years prior to that. And when my father left for good, I felt really angry about it. I felt angry because of what he'd done to my mother. I felt angry because of me and my siblings who were going to be growing up without a dad present. And I felt angry because I thought I was doing a lot more chores than what I should have had to do because he wasn't around. And he would come and visit our house and do things with my younger siblings, and I would avoid him. I didn't want to talk to him, and things went on, and I can't say that I ever talked to him about it or told him that I forgave him or anything like that. I just struggled, and life went on, as life does. And years later, I began to realize, you know, I have carried a lot of anger against my father. And I don't think about it a lot of the times, but certain times it bubbles to the surface. I would like all of you to take a songbook or a Bible or something and just hold it out in your hand. So, does it feel very heavy? Some of you say yes. Some of you, usually like, you know, I could, you know, young people, you could carry this all day long. So I want you to think about this as unforgiveness. You are holding unforgiveness, and it's not very heavy for the moment, but the longer you carry it, the harder it is to hold. And at some point, you can put it down, okay? When you think to yourself, you know, it's heavy enough. I feel comfortable putting this down. You can put it down. And I think unforgiveness is a little bit like this. It doesn't feel heavy. We get through our days. We do things. We get stuff done. And yet, the whole time, we're holding something in our hand that is getting heavier and heavier and affecting different aspects of our life. I'd like to turn to Matthew chapter 18. We're going to read verses 21 through 35. This is a parable talking about forgiveness. Matthew 18, verse 21. Then Peter came to him and said, "Lord, how often shall my brother sin against me and I forgive him? Up to seven times." Jesus said to him, "I do not say to you up to seven times, but up to 70 times seven. Therefore, the kingdom of heaven is like a certain king who wanted to settle accounts with his servants. And when he had begun to settle accounts, one was brought to him who owed him 10,000 talents. But as he was not able to pay, his master commanded that he be sold with his wife and children and all that he had, and that payment be made. The servant therefore fell down before him, saying, 'Master, have patience with me, and I will pay you all.' Then the master of that servant was moved with compassion, released him, and forgave him the debt. But that servant went out and found one of his fellow servants who owed him 100 denarii, and he laid hands on him and took him by the throat, saying, 'Pay me what you owe.' So his fellow servant fell down at his feet, begging him, saying, 'Have patience with me, and I will pay you all.' And he would not, but went and threw him into prison till he should pay the debt. So when his fellow servants saw what had been done, they were very grieved and came and told their master all that had been done. Then his master, after he had called him, said to him, 'You wicked servant, I forgave you all that debt because you begged me. Should you not have also had compassion on your fellow servant just as I had compassion on you, had pity on you?' And his master was angry and delivered him to the torturers until he should pay all that was due to him. So my heavenly Father also will do to you if each of you from his heart does not forgive his brother his trespasses." So I don't know what you think of when you read this story. I hope you're like me, and you just think about how terribly callous the first servant was. Maybe he just comes across as ungrateful. He'd received a healthy dose of grace and did not pass that on to someone else. And we Mennonites don't have easy grace. Not like the Baptists do, anyway. And yet there are many times we don't value grace and we don't understand grace. If you're working for your grace, then it's not really undeserved, is it? When grace becomes an expectation, though, rather than a gift, we value it less than we should. So denarii were about a day's wages for a laborer. 100 denarii would be worth between 3 and 4 months' wages. So you think to yourself what you make in a year and divide that by, you know, let's say 3, and you've got roughly the amount that this servant owed the other one. It's not important to know the exact number. So some people do all these calculations and come up with a dollar number, and it doesn't matter. The point is that this was about a third of a year's work. On the other hand, there are 6,000 denarii in one talent, and the first servant owed 10,000 of those to his master. So he owed his master 600,000 times more than what, or 60,000 times more than what his fellow servant owed. So the question is, why didn't he see the relationship between these two things? And I think maybe the first servant told himself different stories about what was going on. So his debt was not the result of his bad behavior. There were unforeseen circumstances that had happened. He had tried to take care of the debt, and just things conspired against him. He had been working hard, and if he'd been given just a little more time, he probably could have done it. On the other hand, his fellow servant owed him much less. He could pay it, and he was just being stubborn about it. And so he was just deliberately making life more difficult for his fellow servant. And more than that, as we know, this first servant was hard up. His master had wanted payment, and he couldn't pay it. He didn't have anything in his bank account, so he would like some from his fellow servant. And there's a number of different things that we can see about this. First of all, is that the magnitude of what we've been forgiven is vastly different. The grace that we've been extended is huge. It's beyond our comprehension. The second thing is we will never fill our bank account by stealing from our fellow servant's bank account. We can't. I don't know if you've ever thought about that. But so often we think to ourselves, you know, I'm struggling and one of my fellow servants should pick me up. And when Jesus said, I am the vine and you are the branches, he was saying, tie into me. He was not saying, tie into one of the other branches. Now, I do think that we have a responsibility to encourage each other and try to pick each other up and do all that we can for each other. But we need to be tied into Jesus. And as we're tied into Jesus, we will get stronger. And as we tie into healthy people around us, we can't get where we need to get. So when I'm running on empty, it's not my wife's fault. It's not anybody else's fault. And so often, like you read books like the Love Languages book, and the Love Languages books are good because they tell you how to love other people. But there's almost a transactional nature about it. Like, if I love you the way this book tells me, you aren't going to love me, and my bank account is just going to explode. It doesn't really work that way. Jesus finishes this story by telling us that grace will only be extended to those who extend grace through forgiveness of others. So I'm going to talk a little bit about what it means to forgive. So first of all, I think we need to think about something called an injustice gap. So an injustice gap is any time that we perceive an offense against us. So we have an idea of the amount of injustice that was done to us, and it could be large, it could be small. And the larger it is, the harder it is for us to forgive that thing. So when we're the offender, we're always good at explaining why the injustice gap is small and why it was unintentional. On the other hand, when we're the victim, we tend to see it as much bigger. And it's really hard to shrink this injustice gap. So one of the things that we know is that vengeance doesn't fix it. Okay, so if I do something to you to get even, what ends up happening is my injustice gap will actually shrink. I feel better about the situation, but your injustice gap grows. How many of you all have heard of the Hatfields and the McCoys? Yeah, many people. So there is a feud in West Virginia between two families and people connected with those families, the Hatfield and the McCoy family. And it all started off with a hog swimming the Tug River from the McCoy's property to the Hatfield's property. And they confiscated the hog. I guess they thought it didn't belong there. And anyway, they took it. And things got more and more tense between those two families. There were multiple shootings and stabbing episodes. And over about a 28-year period of time, from 1863 to 1891, there were at least 20 people who were killed, and 8 of the Hatfields ended up in jail. And so this is sort of what happens when one person does one thing. It starts off with a pig being confiscated, and things just ramp up and ramp up. And there's more and more anger, and finally people don't even know why they're angry at each other. They just know they're angry. And so there are different ways that we can shrink the injustice gap. So one of the things, as I said, was to get even with a person, just to do something mean to them. It makes you feel better. It's like, ha, you know, you deserved it. If somebody gets punished for their behavior, we may feel better about it. If someone apologizes, we may feel better. If someone offers restitution, that may make us feel better. There are two kinds of forgiveness. So there's something called decisional forgiveness, and this is choosing to forgive somebody else, a decision to act as though someone else is a person of value and that I will not act angry towards them even though they deserve it. And the second thing is emotional forgiveness. So a lot of times people confuse these two things. So emotional forgiveness is an attempt to turn negative emotions that we harbor towards somebody else into something less negative. And I think it's important that we realize that this takes a lot of work. And just because you've decided to forgive somebody does not mean that the emotions that you feel towards them have gone away. And, you know, obviously things differ. If you're driving in Lynchburg and somebody cuts you off, you may be mad at them, but it's going to be pretty easy to lay that down. And on the other hand, if somebody has hurt you deeply over a period of years, it is going to be challenging. And you may never be able to feel really good about your relationship again. So what happens when we experience an offense? Well, there's different things that can happen. Most of us get a little angry. And because we're Mennonites, we don't admit that we get angry. We use words like, I was hurt, I was upset, I was frustrated. But we're angry, we're upset. And then we try to say, you know what, it wasn't that big a deal. I can move on, and it's going to be okay. And then we distance ourselves from the other person. And then I'm convinced that many of us deny that we need to forgive because, you know, it wasn't that big a deal, and we've moved on. And yet we're still carrying something, just like that book. We're still carrying something with us. So certain things that forgiveness is not, and I want this to be really clear because I think people make forgiveness into something it isn't. Forgiveness is not telling someone else What you did isn't a big deal. What they did was a huge deal, and it bothers you. And saying that it wasn't a big deal is not forgiving. I don't even know what it is. Now, there are situations where somebody does something unintentionally, and we do need to say it wasn't a big deal. You know, if you're supposed to meet your spouse at a particular location, a particular time, and they aren't there, and time is ticking by, and you're getting more and more upset, and then they call you and say, "Honey, I witnessed this terrible accident, and I'm doing chest compressions on this lady by the side of the road, and they're bleeding out, and I'm going to be a little late. I'm sorry." Hopefully you're able to say, "Oh, okay, well, keep up those compressions." But there's other situations where it was a really big deal, and you can't just say, "Look, this wasn't a problem." Second is that forgiveness does not take away a need for justice. So if somebody's committed a crime, they should receive appropriate punishment for the crime, and the fact that forgiveness has occurred does not take this need away. Forgiveness is not the same as reconciliation, and there's times where reconciliation is warranted and sometimes it is not, and it's not even safe for the person. So perhaps this is a different question for another day, but I think reconciliation takes two people, where forgiveness at a minimum requires one. And I think this is really important because a lot of people judge a level of forgiveness based on a level of reconciliation, and they are not the same things. So if we judge whether somebody is experiencing forgiveness on whether they hug somebody or hang out with them, that's not a good way of judging it. And sometimes it's just not safe for somebody to reconcile or spend time with somebody else. Forgiveness does not equal emotional healing. So you can make a decision to forgive somebody and yet feel extremely emotional when you're with them and when you think about them. And this does not mean that your decision has no meaning. It has big meaning, but it means that emotions do not go away easily, and a decision does not fix it. And forgiveness is not easy. So I would say that it takes hours and hours to work on a major offense. And it takes huge effort, often working with other people, to be able to lay down serious offenses. The more damage that's been done to a person, the harder it's going to be for them to reach a place of real forgiveness. And maybe as a last thing, forgiveness is not dependent on somebody else. I do think that I need to qualify the statement. So there are things that somebody else can do who has offended you that will make it easier to forgive them. If they apologize, if they seem contrite, if they offer some kind of restitution, ask for forgiveness, that's going to help. If the person receives punishment, that may help too. But at the end of the day, Jesus has asked us to extend grace to other people. You all probably heard of Ruby Bridges. So in 1960, the schools in New Orleans were segregated. The black children went to one school and one set of schools, and the white children went to another set of schools. And Ruby Bridges was one of six children who were chosen to break this segregation barrier. So she was going to a white school, and the white families that, many of the white families were very angry. They pulled their children out of school. Mobs surrounded the school and shouted angry things at this little six-year-old girl. And one woman in the crowd threatened to poison her, while another held up a picture of a black baby in a coffin. And one morning, as she came to the top of the steps, Ruby turned around and seemed to mouth some words at the crowd that was yelling behind her. And her teacher noticed this and talked to a counselor, Robert Coles, who was working with her to deal with the stress of the situation. And Coles asked her afterward, "Who were you talking to, Ruby?" "I was talking to God, praying for the people in the street," she said. "Why were you doing that, Ruby?" "Well, because I wanted to pray for them. Don't you think they need praying for?" Coles said yes, he thought they probably did, but he pushed further. "Where did you learn that from?" from my mommy and daddy and from the minister at the church. I pray every morning when I come to school and every afternoon when I go home. Coles continued, but Ruby, those people are so mean to you. You must have some other feelings besides just wanting to pray for them. No, she said. I just keep praying for them and hope God will be good to them. I always pray the same thing. Please, dear God, forgive them. Because they don't know what they're doing. And maybe there's nothing quite as Christ-like as being willing to forgive an angry mob who hates you only because you've got the wrong color of skin. So how do we experience forgiveness? So sometimes the Bible is long on telling us to do something and it's short on telling us how to achieve that thing. Everett Worthington is a psychologist who has taught and studied the subject of forgiveness for a long time. On January 1st, 1996, Dr. Worthington got a call. His brother had called to check on their mother in Knoxville, Tennessee, and when his mother didn't answer the phone, he drove over to see what was going on. His mother was 90 years old, and someone had broken into her home, apparently to rob her, and when she surprised them, they'd beaten her to death with a crowbar and left the house looking like a disaster area. And Everett was teaching school at Virginia Commonwealth University in Richmond, and he immediately got in his vehicle and he drove out to his mother's house. And he said it was awful. Apparently, his mother had come out and surprised the person who was robbing her home, and they'd just beaten her until she died. She's 90 years old. His brother and sister were there, and they went back to his brother's house, and he described his anger afterwards. He saw a baseball bat in the corner. He told his siblings, I wish I had the murderer here because I would beat him to death with that bat. He wouldn't last 10 minutes. Later on, he went back and tried to sleep, and he couldn't sleep. He just paced back and forth with these angry thoughts in his mind. And he realized here he was, someone who had taught for years on the subject of forgiveness, and he had not even thought about the process of forgiveness, what it would entail, and how he could start to lay these things down. And he began to try to work on that. And he said it took years, years and years. I think that most of us have faced something in our lives that involves an offense, and most of us have struggled to lay that down. And maybe we also have been the offender at times. And we didn't think it was that big a deal. And somebody else is struggling to lay something down that we've done to them. Mark 11:25-26 says, and whenever you stand praying, if you have anything against anyone, forgive him that your Father in heaven may also forgive you your trespasses. But if you do not forgive, neither will your Father in heaven forgive your trespasses. So, you all remember the passage from Matthew chapter 5. It says that if you bring your gift to the altar, and there remember that your brother has aught against you, leave there your gift at the altar and go your way. First be reconciled to your brother, and then come and offer your gift. And the point is that forgiveness comes before worship. Forgiveness comes before prayer. So what should you do if you're dealing with an offense? Well, first of all, you probably need to figure out if it's really something you should be bothered by. Some people hyperanalyze everything. That's not a good thing. Second, you probably should try to address it with the person if you can. Not everybody can. But if there's something going on, the best thing is to go to the person directly. And certainly if we've done something to offend somebody else, we can go to somebody else and say, look, I said something, I did something, and I'm sorry. And I'm just going to touch on this at the end here. There's something called the REACH model, which I think is a really helpful way of breaking down what forgiveness entails. So first of all, REACH is an acronym. It stands for different things. So R stands for recall the hurt. So the hurt was real. And our pain in response to the offense was real. And the point is not that we're just going to minimize that away and just pretend it wasn't something. It was something. And we need to think about that and understand what it was that we're dealing with and be honest with ourselves about it. Second thing is to empathize. So it's important to say that you are never telling yourself that an offense was warranted or that it was a good thing. So suffering is not good. It's never good, and it's never God's intention that we suffer. But we are trying to realize that the person who offended us, who injured us, is someone made in God's image who needs grace. If we can just understand those things, it helps to see somebody who we don't want to think of as being made in the image of God, as being made in the image of God. Third thing is we're giving an altruistic gift. So that's what the A stands for, is altruism. The point is that you're extending grace. This person does not deserve forgiveness, and they never will, but you're choosing to do it in spite of their unworthiness. And perhaps it helps us to understand that we also have received grace. The fourth thing is commit to that forgiveness. Write yourself a note that says that you are going to continue to forgive going forward. And then the fifth thing is to hold on to forgiveness. So there's a tendency for us to lay things down and then to dig them up in the future. And I think it's silly for us to believe that we will forget the damage done to us. We won't. We probably never will, but we can still commit to holding on to forgiveness. So I've thrown a lot of things at you this morning, and I hope that they were taken the way I intended. I've tried to be vulnerable with you all. I have struggled with forgiveness myself, and it's not easy. And it's not a magic bullet that fixes all the problems in your life. Matthew 6, 14 and 15, for if you forgive men your trespasses, your heavenly Father will also forgive you. But if you do not forgive men their trespasses, neither will your Father forgive your trespasses. So instead of the word trespasses, maybe put offenses. Jesus seems to say that our reception of forgiveness from our heavenly Father hinges on our willingness to forgive the small offenses of those around us, and even the big offenses. And I know that sometimes those things feel huge. The people seem unrepentant. The challenge is going to be real, and yet we still have a responsibility to do it. So the goal is never to come to a place where you say the offense wasn't real, that you weren't hurt, and that it wasn't a big deal. Rather, the goal is to reach the place where you can say that you were hurt badly, and you still are hurting, but that you will choose to extend to the other person something they don't deserve, forgiveness.